Hello, I'm Kate Chabot. Welcome to SITREP, your weekly look at the big issues in defence and world affairs. The Prime Minister promises Britain's defence spending will go up sharply to 2.5% of GDP by 2030 to help Ukraine modernise the forces and put defence industry on a war footing.
The biggest strengthening of our national defence for a generation. Over the next 6 years, we'll invest an additional £75 billion in our defence. That starts today.
But not all that money is new. We'll fact check how much extra it will actually mean for the armed forces, and Mike will explain how and when that might improve our military capability. Also on SITREP, months after US military supplies to Ukraine effectively dried up, the Washington deadlock is broken. But what will the new $60 billion package deliver and when?
Now, with the 300-kilometer ATACMS, almost every square meter of Russian-occupied Ukraine will be within range.
And how hundreds of civilian programmers, engineers, and business people spent their weekend in London coming up with problem-solving ideas for soldiers in Ukraine.
There'll be members of the Ukrainian military that are going to be in a virtual call, and the hackers can actually go and sit down and talk to Ukrainian personnel that are currently in eastern Ukraine fighting the Russians. They take some time out to actually give feedback on their ideas.
SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
So, Rishi Sunak says his big announcement on increasing the defence budget is a landmark moment for the defence of the United Kingdom. Mike, what do you think?
Well, yes, it was a landmark moment certainly for this government's approach to defence, because defence was being left aside, generally speaking, as other things were developing and as the international climate's got a lot worse. And Britain is the only country in NATO that hadn't increased its defence expenditure by any significant amount since the beginning of the Ukraine war. So it's landmark in the sense that it's a turnaround in policy. Landmark in numerical terms, not sure. I mean, we'll talk about that. When I first saw the figure on Tuesday afternoon, 75 billion, it didn't look right. And within a couple of hours, you could see what was probably wrong with it. It's not 75 billion, but let's not be churlish about it. I mean, the government is doing the right thing. Overall perspective is that this is a welcome move, but when all is worked through, by 2030, British defence will be back where it was in 2010. So we're still making up ground that we've lost in the last decade and a half. That's the reality of it, I think.
Well, before we look at what this extra money could buy for defence, we need to properly understand the numbers. Let's bring in someone who can explain and fact check the dark arts of Whitehall accounting. Ben Zaranko, Senior Research Economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Good to speak to you, Ben. Let's just start with the most basic question before we break into it a bit further. How much of an increase would this be to the spending power of the Ministry of Defence for every pound they've got now? How many pounds and pennies would they have in 2030?
Well, if you look just at the pounds and pennies without adjusting for anything like prices or the size of the economy, you're looking at going from about 64 billion now to more like 87 billion by 2030. So that's an increase of what, about a third just in the cash terms. Now, once you account for the fact that we'd expect things like the salaries of soldiers to go up over that time, the prices of various other things that the ministry spends on to go up, it's going to be a smaller amount. That'll depend on inflation, maybe more like a fifth. And then if instead you compare to how much of the economy defence spending takes up, it's an increase of more like 10%. So really depends on the question you're asking, but however you look at it, this is quite a big promise and it's going to be quite a big increase in the resources available.
And to get to that target of 2.5% of GDP by 2030, how much is the defence budget going to have to increase each year?
It's going to have to increase quite quickly. You're looking at increasing something like 7 or 8% each year in what we call in real terms, after adjusting for inflation. Now, that those are quite chunky increases, and that's going to increase the spending power of the department quite considerably. It will mean that defence is probably doing better than any other department in Whitehall, at least on the basis of what we know now.
And can we just fact check the Prime Minister's maths here? He said it would mean an extra £75 billion being spent on defence between now and 2030. Does it add up?
I think the number that's been chosen there has been picked because it's the biggest possible sounding number that gives the best possible headlines for the government. I don't think it's the most helpful way to look at it. I think that to get 75 billion, you have to assume that otherwise defence would have received absolutely no increases at all. And it would have been held constant in cash terms for 7 years. Now, that would have meant breaching our commitments to NATO. So unless you think that until yesterday, the government was planning to abandon its NATO commitments, that number doesn't really make sense. I think a better way to think about it is that relative to the increases we might otherwise have expected, we'll probably spend something like 20 billion, 25 billion extra over 6 years, some more like 4 or 5 billion extra per year. Now, that bakes in some increases that would have happened anyway. So as I say, this is a genuine increase for defence, but the 75 billion number isn't very helpful.
So that £75 billion, it's not all new money then, exactly, is what you're saying?
Exactly. The £75 billion includes lots of money that would have gone in anyway, and then the extra bit that's been announced this week. So it's sort of adding it all together, and then not just adding those two things together, adding up 6 years' worth of increases. So that's one way of looking at it. I think a more helpful way to look at it is that by the end, by 2030, which is the final year of plans they've set out, we're spending about 7 billion more than we would have been in a world without this announcement. I think that's more of a helpful way to think about the scale of this. All of this is a little bit dependent on what happens to the economy, but the direction of travel is very clear.
Ben Zaranko from the Institute for Fiscal Studies. So, Mike, Ben's pretty clear. It is a notable increase in defence spending, but not perhaps as big as it might seem. What's it going to buy for the forces?
Yeah, of course, that's not been decided. And it's been a matter of intense speculation this week in the circles that I move in as to what would you want for it? And a couple of the chiefs and deputy chiefs that I've been involved with talking to in other, I mean, I have to say, I don't go in on a one-to-one basis, but I've been in meetings where they're involved. They'll stress that we need to spend this money on making good the deficiencies in the forces presently. And I think James Heapy made the point, ex-Minister for Armed Forces. He said, we need to spend it on all the really boring stuff, like stocks and spares and contingencies for various things, things that the public won't notice, but which will actually make the defence forces more usable and more sustainable. And so that's the big question. How much of this money goes into the basic maintenance of the force in general, and how much can go on either more platforms or more personnel or just more of everything? I would say, where possible, we just want more numbers of things. We don't need particularly to develop new technologies which we're not already developing. We're quite far ahead on technology development. But when we have a technology, we just don't have enough units of it to make the difference that we hope. So I'd say two priorities. One is, as it were, sustaining the forces. That's the first priority, and it's very unglamorous. And then the other one is just expanding the numbers of what we've got. But I mean, that's both of those wishes are a piece of string, and you have to decide, how much of this new money. Ben is absolutely right. In cash terms, it comes out at about, I think, 5 to 6 billion extra a year for the next 5 to 6 years. Well, that doesn't go very far once you start spending it on ammunition stocks and making good on some of the holes in the whole defence estate at the moment.
And indeed, we often talk about this phrase, a black hole in defence budget. The fact that spending plans were already billions of pounds higher than the money they were due to get. How much extra money will be left to buy new stuff once that's accounted for?
Just depends on, how much we put into the hole, as it were, for sustainability. But I would say probably not very much. I mean, the fact is this is all worthwhile, and we should welcome it. I don't want to sound as if we're not welcoming what the government has now done. But I don't think any of us in the defence analysis business thinks that this will do the job. This is the first tranche. The government's committing to it ahead of an election. That's understandable. But more than this will be required, because remember, prominent Conservative politicians only a year or 18 months ago were saying we have to hit 3% of GDP, never mind 2.5%. And that too, 3% of GDP would be a big uplift. And if we were to move from 2.5% to 3%, then we would see some cash that would make a difference that we would be aware of. We'd see more things on the front line. We'd see bigger forces, whereas most of this will go into making good on what we've got now.
Yeah, and really interesting, when Rishi Sunak listed his three key priorities for this money: firing up the UK defence industrial base, modernising the forces and new technology, and backing Ukraine's defence, no mention of numbers of British servicemen and women.
No, and it's interesting that they don't want to address those numbers at the moment, because that becomes very sort of politically toxic. But firing up the defence industrial base is an important thing, because the idea behind this, and it's a good idea, is by committing to 5 years, whether or not the Conservatives will be in government then, of course, we just don't know. But I mean, committing to 5 years gives the defence industries some sense of certainty to restart production lines. So, for instance, I mean, Storm Shadow, you know, very good missile that we give to Ukraine, we operate ourselves. MBDA, they closed down the production line. They produced about 1,000 and then closed the production line because there were no more orders. And so what does it take for them to open the production line again? And for when? You know, for 1 year, for 3 years, for 10 years? So yeah. Getting some certainty, is it worth opening the production lines because the government means it, and this and the next government, whoever they are, will mean it? That's an important element in actually creating a more, not a war economy, but an economy that can cope with higher defence requirements over the long term. And so this government, I think, has taken the first step in that direction. So good for them.
Well, let's just get the thoughts of one of your former colleagues from your time at the Royal United Services Institute, Malcolm Chalmers, who is the Deputy Director General of RUSI.
I don't think it will allow the number of armed forces personnel to grow, not least because there's quite a lot of demand to spend more on better terms and conditions, and a lot of demand to spend more on armed forces pay, maybe especially for those areas in which increasingly the military is uncompetitive compared with the civilian sector. So if you want to keep specialists, if you want to keep people with transferable skills who are absolutely essential to making all our great kit work, then you need to pay them competitive rates. And that's going to, I think, take up a significant part of this.
The Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, said in his announcement, this starts today. But how long will it take for the extra money to start delivering improved capability for the armed forces?
Well, it doesn't start today, in the sense that there is, apart from another $500 million for Ukraine, there is no extra money for this financial year. So the extra money starts about a year from now, in April 2025. The increases are for next financial year, starting in April 2025, and the subsequent 5 financial years. So the planning for increased spending can start now, but the money, the extra money is not going to arrive for some time.
And the Defence Secretary says part of the way they're finding the money will be to cut MOD civil servant numbers from 60 to 50,000. Is that realistic?
Well, you know, the governments in the past have made such promises, and then when they've actually looked at the detail, it has proven not to be realistic, because MOD civilians are employed for a reason. Every one of them is employed for a reason. Of course, there can be efficiency savings. Of course, you can involve new technology and maybe simplify the very complex systems people in the MOD have to deal with. But all that takes reform and time. You can't simply cut out 10,000 MOD civil servants without there being consequences. Does it include the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, for example, or many other specialisms? There might be some stereotype in the public mind that MOD civil servants are mainly pen pushers with bowler hats in Whitehall offices, but the vast majority of MOD civil servants are out in bases and other facilities across the land, and indeed patrolling our oceans.
Good to speak to you, Malcolm Chalmers. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Mike, let's just go back to Malcolm's first point there, spending some of this money on things like improving accommodation, maybe pay rises, incentives for specialist skills. That doesn't immediately transfer to frontline capability, but when the forces are struggling with recruitment, I guess it might be a worthwhile investment.
Yeah, very much so. Because I think, you know, there's a couple of things from what Malcolm said, which are very important. I mean, the forces don't really have a problem with people wanting to join them. And there's been an uptick in last year, people wanting to join the forces as they hear more about the fact that the forces are short of people. But the recruitment processes are too slow and too bureaucratic. So that they need to address that. But then they've got to address the issue of retention. And that's where these sort of spending arrangements that Malcolm was talking about are really important. Because people, once they're in the forces, have got to feel more cared for than they do. It's all very well when somebody's 18 and single that they join up and it's lifestyle and it's fun and it's what they want. But once they're married and they've got a child or two children and the accommodation isn't very good, then they think, well, how long am I going to stay in this? And so that's where improving the conditions within the armed forces is very important to actually improve retention rates, because that's where people the armed forces are losing just people and skills and experience. And if the spending that this can unlock in the next 5 years can address that, then it will be doing something very, very good for defence, which everyone talks about. It doesn't happen quickly enough. Every defence review says we're going to improve it, and they improve it a little bit, but never enough.
Well, let's just address the huge elephant in the room for this announcement. There's an election coming, as we see Rishi Sunak might not be Prime Minister by this time next year. Labour, as yet, is not promising to stick with this plan if it wins power. Let's just hear briefly from Shadow Defence Secretary John Healey.
We share the same ambition as the government because we must do more to deal with the growing threats.
Yeah, yeah.
We want this to be fully costed and fully funded. We want it to be set out in the government's baseline budgets. This 2030 target is not.
So, Labour says it has the same defence spending target but won't commit to the same deadline. Does that make this announcement meaningless until we have an election result, Mike?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we have to accept this is electoral politics. So this, in a way, it shot the fox for the opposition. What this has done is undermine what the Labour opposition were going to say about defence in any case. And so that puts Labour on the back foot. And Labour, their policy, of course, will go into the election saying we'll have a review. So no, they won't commit to this, because then it looks as if they're just following the government's lead. But in reality, I'd be amazed if they didn't do at least this. I mean, they will match this, I'm certain. And we'll probably have to announce more quite quickly. But they're not going to say that in an election campaign. So they retreat into saying, well, we wouldn't do it this way. We don't believe it. We want to see it fully funded and fully costed. I mean, Labour have got to find a way of, as we're going parallel with this, without looking as if they're joining the same line of development.
And one other potential political dimension to this, Rishi Sunak made the announcement while standing next to the NATO Secretary General, and we're less than 3 months from a NATO leaders' summit.
Yeah, and that's really important too, because when it comes to the Washington summit in the summer, the European NATO allies want to go to Washington, and as we're committed to Joe Biden's commitment to Ukraine and Joe Biden's commitment to NATO, and show that the Europeans are not sitting back and just assuming that America will do it all. That's the way it always looks to certain members of Congress, but that this is proactive, joint defence on behalf of NATO. And of course, Rishi Sunak wants to show to the United States that Britain is pursuing its traditional self-appointed role as acting as a sort of defence leader in Europe. He's had a difficult time convincing a lot of people of that so far, because he's not naturally a defence-minded prime minister. And so this is Rishi Sunak on the campaign trail in the United Kingdom, but also trying to make a point to the United States. And I'm sure that the government will try to make it very hard indeed when they all assemble in Washington for this very big anniversary summit.
So let's get back to the basic question. How likely do you think what's been said this week will result in improved British military capability? And if so, when will we be able to see that actually happening?
Well, yes, it will contribute to an improvement in capability, as Malcolm Chalmers said, from next year. When will we see the real effects of it? Probably not until 28, 29, 30, in terms of things that will be evident to the rest of the public and to our adversaries and allies. And this will be, I think, viewed as a waypoint on a longer journey. And I'd be surprised if we don't commit to 3% GDP at some point in the next couple of years, because I think we will need to. So this, I think, will go back as an important first step, but it won't be the end of the story for sure.
Well, part of Rishi Sunak's defence spending announcement was a commitment to continue military aid to Ukraine to the tune of £3 billion a year for as long as is needed. And we should note Labour is signed up to that too, so it stands whatever the election result. While that's very welcome in Kyiv, even more welcome is a new tranche of military aid from the US, $60 billion worth, after months of wrangling held it up in America's domestic political battles. But what will it deliver? How quickly can it be got to the battlefields where soldiers are ruthlessly rationing artillery shells? And how much difference will it make to the war? Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, former commanding general of the US Army Europe, is now NATO's senior mentor for logistics.
It's a relief to see it finally happen, although we should have never been in this situation. This should have been done many months ago, and I'm embarrassed that it took us so long. It's a significant amount of stuff that's coming, and I've heard that it will include the long-range precision, 300-kilometer range ATACMS, which is very important. But I have to say that this package is just enough to keep Ukraine in the fight. It clearly is not enough to help them win. And unfortunately, I think that's the desired outcome of the administration, is just to keep Ukraine in the fight.
We'll talk about when in a moment. But first, what will this money be spent on? You mentioned the long-range ATACMS. What else?
Most of it is stuff that's already been purchased or developed, or we have it, and that's what's going to be sent. And so the money will be used to replace what's being sent. It's equipment and ammunition and capabilities that already exist. I'm still waiting to see what the final list is, but to me, the most important thing was the ATACMS. But I've also heard reports that there's a significant number of Bradley fighting vehicles that are included. And I've seen a lot of positive reports from Ukrainians of how well the Bradley has performed. So I think that's a good thing.
When will the equipment start getting to the front line and then make a difference?
Well, excellent question. I imagine that the Department of Defense, and I've seen several reports to this effect, has been leaning forward, let's say, in anticipation of this. Things that were at hand, whether here in Europe or back in the States, they will have already been set up for the quickest possible delivery to get them into the transition site in Zhezhou, Poland, so that they could then move onward into Ukraine. So there'll be some things that arrive immediately. Some will take a few more weeks. Battlefield effects, yeah, I think, frankly, it's going to be a few weeks before you start really seeing the big difference. Although there are some people that are saying that the Ukrainians have already started increasing rates of fire of some weapons that they have been shepherding the last few weeks because they weren't certain they were going to get replaced. So you may see some increase that way. The biggest effect on the battlefield, of course, is for the Kremlin to realize that their hope that the United States was going to quit, that the West would give up on Ukraine, that's over. And that's a real problem for the Kremlin.
And what does Ukraine need most urgently? What would you be prioritizing if you were in charge of this?
Well, in addition to, number one, hearing the West, especially the United States, declare that it is our strategic priority that Ukraine wins. They actually defeat Russia. That would really be an important thing to provide a strategic end state. In terms of material, air and missile defense would have to be number one because the destruction that the Russians are causing every day on Ukrainian cities, on civilian populations. It's just incredible to me that the world is, other than wringing their hands, the world is not really doing that much. We've got to fix that. I mean, we were willing to have Royal Air Force, U.S. Air Force pilots flying to help Israel protect them from Iranian rockets. And Israel has like the best air defense in the world. Why are we not willing to help Ukraine do that? But that would be number one. Number two, long-range precision strike capability, things like Storm Shadow, which I think UK has just announced they're going to provide more, the 300-kilometer ATACMS from the United States, Taurus from Germany, which unfortunately still doesn't appear to be in the offing. These are important because that's how you defeat the only advantage the Russians have, which is their mass, their large numbers. If you can destroy headquarters and logistics, then you neutralize the capability or the advantage of mass. And we know where everything is. You just got to be able to reach it. And now with the 300-kilometer ATACMS, almost every square meter of Russian-occupied Ukraine will be within range.
President Biden says aid will start being sent this week. Is it already stockpiled in Europe, or does a lot still need to be manufactured and sent across the Atlantic?
No, I think the stuff that's coming already exists. Its location, I don't know. I'm sure that some of it is in Europe. Some of it will be delivered into Rzeszów in Poland. I think there's probably some things, perhaps some ammunition or whatever, that will be flown in to get it there as fast as possible. So what's coming, I believe most of it already exists. And what's going to be spent will be to replace what's coming.
$61 billion, a huge number. How long will that keep a flow of military aid running to Ukraine?
I can't put an exact number on it. I think certainly for several more months. But, you know, Kate, the thing about numbers, the only number that matters, in my view, is percentage of requirement. The requirement, what's needed to help Ukraine win, to actually win. And so whatever that number is, then the only thing that we should be tracking is what percentage has been delivered of what needed to win, whether we're talking about types of munitions or types of vehicles or whatever. And I think we're still in a very low percentage of what's required to win. I would expect that what's being provided now should be enough to help them sustain themselves for 3 or 4 months. But of course, the enemy will determine some of that. You know, if there are larger Russian attacks, then you end up shooting more artillery ammunition than you would otherwise, for example.
Ben Hodges, good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the privilege.
Mike, General Ben was talking up the need for ATACMS long-range missiles, and we've since learned, in the last 24 hours actually, the US had already supplied some in secret, and Ukraine used them for the first time last week.
Yes, and in fact, they might have used them before that, because remember when the Kerch Bridge was first hit, some of us speculated then that the only thing we could think of that could have done that was an ATACMS missile. I mean, at the time, the suspicion was that it was a truck bomb, a big truck bomb. But I just looked at it again and again, and I couldn't see how a truck traveling on top of the bridge could do that much damage below the bridge when explosions go upwards rather than downwards. And some of us said, I wonder if they've got ATACMS missiles. And it wasn't officially denied at the time. The Pentagon wouldn't confirm or deny that they'd supplied ATACMS. So I think the Ukrainians have had a few ATACMS for a while because they had the launchers for them. They can use them for them from the launchers they've got for MLRS rocket rounds. So, yes, I think they have had some, but they need, as General Ben said, they need to use them in some numbers now to compensate for the mass that the Russians are bringing forward. If they can hit the rear areas, they can hit the headquarters and the communications nodes, then they can negate the almost these human wave attack effects, which the Russians are now launching all the way along the front.
And interesting that there is anecdotal evidence that rationing of artillery shells has eased now that Ukraine knows more will be on their way. You were making that point a few weeks ago, that it was as much uncertainty about the future of supplies as it was immediate shortages that was forcing these difficult decisions on when to use them.
Yes, and I think as General Ben said, there's the anecdotal evidence, and I've seen it as well, that the rates of fire have already increased. I mean, once the decision was taken last Saturday in the House, US House of Representatives, and that decision, of course, was not sort of seen through until yesterday, on Wednesday. Nevertheless, because it was going to happen, the Ukrainians were able to bring a lot more ammunition forward, and they're already seeing the benefits of that. So this does mark a new phase in their resistance. I mean, they're still losing some territory, small amounts of territory. They're really pressed at Ochetine at the moment. There's some very bad stuff gone on there from their point of view. At least two brigades have had to be withdrawn for unpleasant reasons because they've just become combat ineffective rather than been reduced by attack. They've internally dissolved in effect. So the Ukrainians have still got some big problems, but yeah. the trend in the local offensives is beginning to turn a little bit.
And Ben thinks this aid can keep Ukraine in the fight for another few months. Is that it? Or do you think it could make more of a difference?
Well, I think it'll make more of a difference because if they stay in the fight, then this Russian offensive, it's not a strategic offensive, but this Russian pressure all the way around the front will run out of steam. They always do eventually. Every offensive runs out of steam. So if the Ukrainians stay in the fight till the summer, the Russians then become exhausted by this particular push that they've created over the last month or so. Then the Ukrainians may find some opportunities in the summer. And I'm sure that Zelensky is very, very keen on mounting something in the summer. We'll see if they do or not. So, I mean, staying in the fight also means that the Russian morale will decrease and their sense of exhaustion by, let's guess, end of June or July may be such that the Ukrainians will find that there are some opportunities.
News, discussions and analysis. This is SITREP.
Now, Mike, you like your film references, so I'm updating a quote from The Sound of Music. Stand by. How do you solve a problem like tracking small but lethal enemy drones over the battlefield of Ukraine? Really catchy, isn't it? That was written for me, Mike, okay? It wasn't my idea.
Well, Rodgers and Hammerstein who wrote The Sound of Music, they'd struggle with that one. I mean, Hammerstein wrote the lyrics. So if I mean, Rodgers could do music to it, but if you could find a rhyme for Battlefields of Ukraine, then you're welcome.
Well, one way of coming up with new solutions to any kind of problem is what's called a hackathon, an event for rapid and collaborative engineering to develop new ideas by bringing together software and hardware engineers, potential end users, and people who could fund it all. At the weekend, hundreds of people gathered in London for a defence tech hackathon, trying to come up with new ideas that could swiftly help Ukraine in its fight back against Russia. SITREP's Tom Sable spoke to some of those taking part, including data scientist Connor Walker, who has hands-on experience to understand what Ukraine's troops may want and need.
I was in the mortar platoon in the Parachute Regiment and then served tour of Afghanistan. Out the back end of coming out of that, I wanted to go more on the tech side. I did a cybersecurity module in the army. I ended up like self-teaching myself data science and programming as a whole, so that when I came out, I was in like a good set to get a job.
Talk to me about the challenge today that you're taking on and how long you think it will take.
Yeah, sure. So it's anti-drone interceptor. Hopefully we'll get it done by tomorrow. We'll like to see. But the idea being is that we get given the coordinate of the recon drone. We create a flight path for that. And then relative to our handheld drone, we'll then autonomously take out the other drone with no interaction from a human being.
My name is Dimitrios Kotas. I'm the founder and CEO at Lambda Automata. We are one of those new defense tech startups, if you like. We think there are some big gaps right now in the defense industry, especially around building low-cost, small, cheap, autonomous systems. However, there is a ton of talent out there. So we are looking for people with passion, ingenuity and creativity on building such systems. Those can be autonomous navigation systems, targeting systems, detection systems for low-cost drones or counter-drone systems.
Richard Pass, CEO and co-founder of Future Forces. I think what really inspired us was that on the battlefield in Ukraine, it's the startups that are defining the battlefield yet. The gains that are needed to actually gain an edge over the Russians are coming from young founders like you've seen here today. We source problems direct from Ukraine. The problems you've chosen for track one are all about counter-UAS, jamming, emissions tracking, stuff that the Ukrainians need more than anything else on the battlefield right now. Tonight, the hackers here will have the opportunity for 2 hours to speak with real end users that are actually on the battlefield in Ukraine right now, get feedback and ideas, because you know, Ukraine takes this stuff very, very seriously. One of the best minds in the world working on these really important problems, because their country's future depends on it.
Exactly. I mean, one of the lessons learned from Ukraine, and especially from the way the Ukrainian armed forces fought, especially over the first months of the invasion, is that you can achieve many things if you pair the right people. I mean, and by right people, I mean builders and end users at the same room, and you give them a clear mission.
And Tom is with us now. Tom, tell us a bit more about who was there, because there were quite a few people in uniform too.
So the event officially welcomed, quote, the UK's brightest young minds. A lot of these are strangers from different countries, to team them up, but also to connect them with other startups, investors, national security leadership, and also these end users that we heard of. So basically armed forces from around the world, UK, Ukraine, US, Australia, taking a look to see how they are working out these problems and what they come up with. Now, that's significant with all these stakeholders all in one room, because usually the amount that goes into identifying a problem, building the solution, then getting it off the ground, that can firstly take a long time. Ukraine doesn't have that. But also it costs a lot more to go through consultancies, for example, to deliver these solutions when you can just pile, it turns out, everyone into one room for about 50 hours. So that explains the who and the why there were so many energy drinks and crisps being handed out, but also why we haven't actually seen this style of defence hackathon really until now.
And a winner was chosen. What was the winner and what happens to that and the other ideas?
So first of all, the winners and the runners up will all meet with venture capitalists in the next few weeks, as well as the UK MOD officials to do their thing again, but maybe on a more case-to-case basis. The actual winner was Team Carlito, who came up with a first-person view drone emissions tracking system. So Ukrainian electronic warfare and drone operators on the video call that we heard of there said that they're actually very keen to receive something like that. So immediate positive feedback for Team Carlito. The emphasis that I would stress here has been that you can't actually deliver something war winning in 2 days. If you imagine that this was an exam, they're giving out marks for showing they're working out, not necessarily the answers.
Yeah, Mike, the term hackathon, it's very 21st century, but I guess the basic principle, some hands-on brainstorming, is not that new.
No, because in warfare, the military and defence always tries to pull in areas from the civilian technology field. What's interesting about this one is that, you know, generally speaking, the military pulls in the edges of civilian technology where they're useful. But here, civilian technology is the front and center of the revolution. It's the military which is on the edges of it. So here, you know, the hackathon is a great example, I think, of the centrality of non-military civilian innovation, commercial innovation. And the military is in a way struggling to learn from it. And this sort of thing is I think, a way of highlighting what the possibilities are and how quickly they might be operationalized.
So, Tom, what was it like being there amongst those fizzy drinks you mentioned and the brightest minds?
With the brightest minds. Humbling, Kate, humbling. I am. Look, I'm someone who couldn't log into the coffee shop Wi-Fi on the way back from the London Defence Hackathon. So it's actually quite stunning to see how quickly someone can pick up a drone, take it apart, figure out how to fly it, how to counter it, figuring out measures to counter those counter methods, and they really take to it that quickly. So it's eye-opening for me to have been there around that. Just even for the short time that I was there, I didn't opt in for the all-nighter.
And on a serious note, Tom, it was industry-driven and also very much focused on Ukraine. Is there anything in it for Britain's armed forces?
Yeah, so there's several strands really for the UK. So potentially you can form these relationships with these problem solvers, as we mentioned, enter business with the startups, a lot of the individuals there. You know, we know they're bright. They're not going to miss the opportunity while they're solving these problems to be showing off what they've got going on with their own startup companies. But it's also primarily for the UK and UK defence and security. It's about people. We know that they need more, but we are also aware that they need a certain type of person to be helping to solve future problems. And so it's quite relevant that a lot of these people, they're data scientists for retailers. they haven't necessarily worked with defence problems before, but as I said before, they're able to pick them up and in a number of days actually come up with solutions or very nearly do so.
Tom, good to speak to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mike, one thing that really stands out about this hackathon is the fact that not only could they get Ukrainian troops on the battlefield to set out the problems they'd like addressed, that the teams in London could actually speak to them in situ, get feedback and actually include those people they're trying to help in that brainstorming process.
Yeah. Do you know, it reminded me of the, you know, the medical work of David Knott, the surgeon, you know, battlefield surgeon. Yeah, David Knott, very distinguished surgeon. And he pioneered some years ago the ability to sit in Manchester and talk directly to medical teams in the middle of critical life-saving operations in Aleppo, in Syria. Mm-hmm. And he was able, through modern communications, to literally guide them. He could see what they were doing. He could talk them through it. And that was remarkable and as now is being done quite a lot. But he pioneered all that. And this strikes me as a bit similar. The idea that you can have people who can't be in the battle area but can be as good as and get, you know, immediate feedback. I mean, that's really quite remarkable. And I think it's interesting that it seems to have been operationalized in the medical field before the military field, rather than the other way around, which is the way it normally works.
I think Grey's Anatomy's got some work to do there on its scripts in the future.
Yeah, indeed.
Mike, yeah, thanks so much, Mike. And thanks to all of our guests. That's all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Until then, you can always catch up with past programmes you might have missed online at bfbs.com/SITREP, the Forces News YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.